What you're about to listen to was originally broadcast on 98.5 Sunshine FM, Perth, Western Australia. For details, go to the website 98five.com.
98.5, this is Weekdays with Mike. Good afternoon. Now, with all the federal governments, with a new Labor government, what can we expect from our new federal Labor government? And joining me on the line this afternoon to have a chat about this is regular guest Simon Creek from HHG Legal Group. Good afternoon, Simon.
Good afternoon, Mike.
We're talking about our new federal Labor government. Now, as normal, it's pretty normal that both parties, Labor have made a lot of promises during the election campaign, and around about $19 billion worth, in fact. And there were some key promises. What are your thoughts on, are they going to be able to deliver, particularly on the back of COVID? Easy to make promises, isn't it?
It's very easy. And both parties, major parties, did. And I think we all know that really, this last federal election was a bit of a watershed moment for Australia in that neither of the major parties saw an increase, not even Labor. I mean, we know that the Libs got decimated in WA, but the big winners were the independents, the new teal independents. And whilst they haven't got perhaps the balance of power they hoped they'd achieve, and Labor does have a majority government, it would appear, I think they're going to be very vocal when it comes to making sure that Labor does deliver on its promises. And I don't envy our Prime Minister, given the wish list that he has promised the nation, whilst at the same time promising various cuts and revenue cuts along the way. You know, it's all very well to promise what is some $19 billion worth of promises. But you really should be outlining to all of us, I think, very quickly now, how you're going to pay for them, given that you have at the same time promised to cut different taxes and effectively introduce some new revenue measures but get rid of others. So it's going to be a big call. It's going to be a very big call.
And also, I would have thought pretty challenging in the 3 year term that they're in. I mean, I know it's the state's a 4 year term. It's interesting. It's a lot to do just within the first term, if that's what they're expecting.
Look, I think one of the best measures for reform within federal politics would be a longer term. It's extremely short. I think it's one of the shortest terms of a federal government of any Western country in the world. Mm. And, you know, when we look at it, as my whole team has, through the lens of a law firm and not just political and social commentary, one of our biggest concerns is always the amount of time it takes to pass new legislation, the time it takes to introduce law reform. Mm. And, you know, really, you are looking at about a three-year window for major law reform, and any new spending, any new cuts also need to be underpinned by legislation. These things have to get through both houses, but more importantly, they need to involve, you know, considerable public consultation, and that takes forever and a day. Big pressure there, big pressure. And I think if we were to summarise all in one go before we jump into the detail, what this government has promised is probably this. It's promised to respond to increasing cost of living pressures. We all know that's happening. We all know we're entering an inflationary environment. Yeah. But it's promised to do that probably without having all of the information that it's soon going to find on its lap.
Interesting. Simon, on that, we'll take a break. We'll come back and chat some more. You are on 98.5 Weekdays with Mike. Joining me on the line is regular guest Simon Creek from HHG Legal Group, and we are chatting about what we can expect from our new federal Labor government. Back after Michael Bublé. Simon, childcare was the biggest single spending measure in the Labor campaign, with a whopping $5.4 billion pledge to increase subsidies for 96% of families. What will this mean for the working mum and family, you think?
Well, look, My brief today from you, Mike, is to be as independent and apolitical about these promises as possible. Mm. And so, you know, I love being able to do that because it enables me to, on the one hand, look for the good, but also hopefully bring to everybody's attention some of the lacking detail.
Sure.
And look, here, I think we definitely do have an enormous issue to watch very carefully. On the one hand, it's a measure that absolutely recognises the value of the working parent, particularly the working mother. I think it's useful in terms of our current labour shortages. We genuinely need everybody in the workforce that we can get right now. The economy needs that. Mm. So in that sense, philosophically, it's a good move. The devil, though, is in the detail here more than anywhere. And we've got to remember that the Coalition increased childcare subsidies by 30% for families with two or more children just earlier this year. And that's already going to be costing us $1.7 billion over 3 years. Labor has matched that commitment and then offered to extend the subsidy boost to families with just one child in childcare, capping at 90%. And then goes much, much further, and the means testing applied to the subsidies is still there for a household income of up to $530,000.
Whoa.
So that's where the big money expenditure is coming in. And I suppose, again, philosophically and totally independently, I have to ask out loud, do Australians all feel that families with a combined household income of up to $530,000 need taxpayer-funded childcare subsidies? That's a very high figure, I think, for most Australian families to get their heads around. Look, it's not that long ago, it seems, that $150,000 a year was a high salary in this country. We know that's not necessarily the case now, but a combined household income of $530,000.
Wow, that's a lot. That's huge.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I would have thought that's a household that's doing very well. Mm. And the question is, do they need those subsidies? Should the taxpayer be behind that? Look, again, time will tell, but I guess this is going to encourage pretty much all potentially working mothers to look very carefully at how quickly they now come back to the workforce. I hope that is a positive return that actually helps the country pay for what is an enormous promise of further expenditure.
Mm, and again, I wonder whether we're going to see that pretty well straight away in the first term, I wonder.
Well, I guess the labour shortages are here and now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why if this promise is going to be followed through on, it needs to be implemented immediately. Mm. Once we see what I hope is going to be, I think we all hope is going to be a steadier influx of workers from overseas returning to Australia, then perhaps the current labour shortage will be eased in that way. But right now, it does make sense to encourage every single possible worker to get out there because it is crippling business right across Australia at the moment. None of us can find staff and there is no discriminator there. It's law to medicine to retail to trades. Everybody is short-staffed.
Indeed. Simon, I'll put you back on hold. We'll come back. I'm keen to talk to you about climate change. We'll get your thoughts on that. Now, Simon, the Labor Party committed to cut emissions by 43% within the next decade and reach net zero by 2050, whatever that means. How do they plan to do this? And can it be done as governments before them have tried and failed? What are your thoughts on climate change?
It's a fascinating question now, given the results of the election and how big an issue this does seem to be for many, many Australians. I'd say out of all of the issues that both major parties campaigned on, this is perhaps the one that's caught everybody by surprise the most. It was obviously a flagship platform for the Teal independence, and it seems to have resonated across the Australian community.
Yeah.
It doesn't for me, though, change two things. One, I still struggle with the notion, and I'm just going to put it out there for listeners to either debate, agree or disagree with, I still struggle with the notion that families and struggling Australians, you're literally worried about rising cost of living, are going to be more concerned about the climate. That is, you know, a thought I'm going to watch and see how the public react. Mm. And I think one of the reasons for it, my second point, is that we all know we are not even close to becoming one of the biggest offenders in this space. And as a result, if we're going to take our targets too far and in such a way that it does actually jeopardise the economy, has an impact on jobs, I just think we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Now, that is not to say, before the phone starts ringing, that is not to say that I don't think we should be doing everything we can. There's no doubt that part of any country's commitment to addressing climate change is a philosophical one. It's a perhaps even a moral issue to be debated in that, you know, we have this wonderful planet. A pile of us believe it was made by, you know, a God who gave it to us to look after. And I think there's a responsibility that comes with that. And it's probably one I've underestimated in the past. And it's not a bad thing that this election's given us all a reminder that we have a responsibility there. But the target, cutting emissions by 43% within the next decade, well, you're right. This has been tried before. Mm. It hasn't worked. And at the end of the day, you know, the cost of the budget over the forward estimates is about $700 million. The Albanese government say that it should create another 604,000 jobs by 2030. Mm. But there's a lot of speculation behind that. That is not something we've seen the detail on at all. And I know that you can see from the workings that have been published that there's a big hope here. I'd say it's a hope on the part of the Albanese government that the private sector is going to chip in $52 billion to make this happen. Now, that is not secured. That is not safely locked down. And at the end of the day, my concern is, again, that push those businesses in this country, which do employ so many people, too far, and we will actually damage the economy when we least need that. Mm.
Interesting, Simon. And also just on that, I mean, the Greens' vote was certainly an indication of where people are at and what they're concerned about based on the results of the Greens party as well.
Look, the Greens did well in that they didn't lose seats and they, I think you could say in all fairness, took the fight on their platforms to the Teal independents quite well.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Nationals didn't lose any seats. It's only the big parties, the major parties that did. And I still think these Teal independents are the ones that are the most responsible for now climate change being a much bigger issue for this country than it was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think ultimately the day of reckoning for everybody is going to when we get closer to this legendary 2050.
Yes.
Because both major parties, you know, have said they will reach net zero emissions by then, but nobody is clear how they're going to do it.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting, Simon. I was on pre-polling. I ran it as a federal Senate candidate in this election.
You did.
And I was pre-polling for the 2 weeks in the lead-up, and I didn't hear one person ask about climate. I'm just purely providing the feedback. It was a lot of other things with cost of living, but not too much feedback on climate change. Now, Simon, Australia's incoming Indigenous Affairs Minister hopes the country can have a referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament as soon as May next year. What would this mean for Australia's Indigenous population and our country as a whole, you think?
So we could spend a long time getting into this issue because it's such an important one for Australia. I think that, particularly as it's Reconciliation Week this week, we need to focus on what I hope this federal government is going to achieve in terms of, yes, reconciliation at a very high level and I guess, in the form of a bright light amidst what is still a very dark and untouched problem across Australia. But also, I hope that we're going to be able to see as part of that actual, real, on-the-ground, practical change when it comes to addressing the enormous health and social issues that Indigenous Australia very disproportionately faces today. So in a first step, or in looking forward, it's pretty clear that you know, the Prime Minister is very behind an Indigenous voice in Parliament, and the Indigenous voice being enshrined in our Constitution. It's, I think, very important to him, and I, again, hope this is followed through, that effectively the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which is a document calling for greater recognition of Indigenous people, be given sufficient oxygen. I don't think it's been debated by the Australian community anywhere near enough. In fact, whenever I bring it up in conversation, nobody seems to have heard of it, which is a great shame, because it's an important... I think we are at a bit of a crossroads on this issue as a country. And this concept of the Indigenous voice being enshrined in the Constitution can only happen through a referendum. And so, you know, in order for Australians to vote at a referendum, they need to know what they're voting about. Mm. And as a result, I would simply suggest this government needs to embark on a pretty strong campaign of public education. And certainly, I don't think it's an issue that the Morrison government handled well. I have to say, the whole response to this came across as quite a casual dismissal. And there are some pretty strong voices in both major parties who are against the issue being constitutionally enshrined. I just think that that little debate there about whether or not it should happen took oxygen away from the fact that we as a country need to know what's being proposed, really understand why, ask ourselves what type of a difference it might make to the dignity of the traditional landowners, and then vote at a referendum. And I'd say we're at the beginning of that national conversation.
Well, they're looking at May next year, so we're basically looking at 11 months. So you think that whole education process would be swift action, potentially?
Well, therein is my concern, I guess. I don't know if this can be handled in that time. But having said that, you know, determination by the Prime Minister can make it happen in that time frame. There's no doubt about it. But he has a lot on his plate. And it's going to be interesting, because I think this is, you know, an issue that it's very easy to comment on from opposition and very hard to practically work with in government. So it'll be a good test of this government as to whether or not it is able to put its money where its philosophy and well intention and heart might be. Because let's be honest, great intentions, they're just not enough.
Yeah. Simon, we'll take a break. We'll come back and wrap things up. Simon, just to finish off today, what are your thoughts on the future as we look forward to, I mean, for so long it's been Labor and Liberal showdown, and now there's been so many minor parties and independents coming through. Do you think the future federal parliament could look, whoever forms government, could look quite different?
Again, it'd be great to take a day on air to discuss this one and get everybody calling in. But without that time, I think a couple of important points need to be made before answering you outright. First of all, it really worries me that yet again, I think we've had a federal election which shows too many Australians don't understand the difference between the upper and lower houses. Mm-hmm. They don't understand the role of the Senate, it being set up to be a true house of review,
spot on,
not necessarily a forum for just blocking government decisions. And because of that, there's a lot of research on this and a lot of, well, I should say opinion evidence out there on this. I'm not convinced that when people look at those two ballot slips, that they really know exactly what their vote in each one of them represents. And so, you know, even, I have to say, others I've been talking to earlier today, you know, highly educated individuals are confusing in their conversation the concept of a, you know, majority in the lower house and a very broad crossbench in the Senate. Mm. At the end of the day, this government has maintained or formed a majority government in the lower house. The Senate is what the Senate is. It's there to review, and it's just going to be very hard to figure out how to get so many independent minds together to get policy through the upper house. But yes, you're right. Apart from that soapbox issue of mine, which I think is an important one, the reality is we are now looking at an election which has said to us people aren't happy with either major party.
Yep.
And what does that spell for the formation of another major party? And look, it's a fact that other Western democracies around the world have often got three or four relatively major parties. And, you know, the UK for a long while has had three. But they don't have the same structure as us. They don't have a House of Review. And so that accountability that comes with a number of major parties is even more important there. I think it's also important to note that the Liberal Party in its current guise was only formed in 1944. The Labor Party was formed in 1901, technically, post-independence. And when you think about the Libs in particular and why that party was formed to stand up for the forgotten people of Australia and on the major platforms of free enterprise and social equality, I think that party needs to look at itself and say, well, have we simply lost our way? Because those themes, I think, resonate throughout Australia more now than ever. The Labor Party, likewise, formed on the back of the working man with the support of all of the unions and Catholic progressives. Again, really, is that what the Labor Party stands for today? Yeah. I'm not convinced most people would see that.
Yeah.
So that opens the door for another party, and it really is an opportunity created by Labor, by the major parties not listening. That's the message that this election has sent across the country. You haven't listened, and so we've looked for an alternative voice. And we now have this this move. Will it form or lead to the formation of another major party? Literally, time will tell. What I think we can say is that if both Labor and Liberal do not reform and really work out what they're there for and who their target voter is, then this trend will continue.
It's going to be fascinating to watch the next federal election, that is for sure. Simon, just to quickly finish off today, we are out of time. Just changing tact a little bit, we've got our June appeal coming up, which you are familiar with, and this year's theme is about being seen and heard. Can I ask you, what do you think needs to happen to see and hear a positive change in our community?
Well, the one word, even though personally I wasn't persuaded by it, that our new Prime Minister used in his victory speech on the night of the election was unity. And I think, you know, all of us as Australians deep down crave unity. We are becoming a more and more divided country. I think that troubles everybody who sits down to actually think about it. And it's incumbent upon all of us to do our bit in terms of uniting this country and not dividing it. I think in turn, that means we all need to take far more attention, we'll pay far more attention to politics. We are a very apathetic country and we scramble to figure out who we're going to vote for, you know, 3 days out of an election. That's not really good enough, because if we let things slide to that point, then we're not able to have an influence, to be seen, to be heard during the term of a government, which is when they need to hear from all of us. And I'm talking about all Australians.
Yeah.
You know, for me as a Christian and as a lawyer who believes in justice and access to justice, it's very important that I speak up on protection of religion and protection of the disadvantaged, because, you know, if I'm not seen and I'm not heard, I'm not having any impact. I'm not being of influence. And every single Australian can be of influence. And I don't think we as a country understand just how powerful the vote and the voice during a term of government of every Australian actually is. And we need to get back to that. Now, whether that's public education, I don't know. But whatever it is, we need to be seen, to be heard, to take a public stand for things that might not necessarily be popular, but are critical for looking after those people that need us to stand up because they can't.
Well done. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's been lovely.
My pleasure. Look, you asked me to come and talk politics, and you know, I love it. Law, politics, business. Well, I should put my faith ahead of that, but all of those things, always happy to talk for far too long.
Indeed. Simon, we really appreciate your time today. We are running up to news and sport. Apologies. We're going to be on time, I think. But thanks to Simon Creek from HHG Legal Group. You are on 98.5, and this is Weekdays with Mike.
For more details on this and other programs, contact 98.5 Sunshine FM, Perth, Western Australia, or visit the website 98.5. 98FIVE.com.